Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla. Joining me is Layla Mutin, Hoffman Center nutritionist, and we're answering a question about the safety of probiotics. Are there some circumstances in which probiotics are unsafe? And Layla, could you just repeat what you said in part one? Because there's an article. Where is that article?
It's on WebMD. And the question being, are probiotics safe for everyone? And part of the answer here that's important is, although no studies have shown probiotics to be harmful in healthy people, Barry Goldman of Tufts University School of Medicine says, terminally ill cancer patients and people with conditions with potential for leaky bowels, including acute pancreatitis, should not consume probiotics. And apparently there was a study that showed people with acute pancreatitis using probiotics doubled their risk of dying.
Okay, so let me address that. And I've looked at this somewhat. And, hey, you know, it really would make sense to take very sick patients in the hospital and give them probiotics because they receive so many antibiotics. They're on powerful acid-blocking medication. And they have terrible dysbiosis. They have overgrowth of harmful bacteria. And so researchers have asked the question, would it be appropriate to give patients in the intensive care unit, for example, very sick patients, probiotics? And the answers have been mixed. So I'm not going to take the position that it's always harmful. There are some studies that suggest benefit, but there are actually some studies that suggest harm. And harm can occur in a couple of ways. One, you know, as they state correctly, when you're really sick, you develop what's called a leaky gut syndrome, which is literally there are microscopic holes in your intestinal tract that allow intestinal contents to pass through the wall of your intestine into the bloodstream and circulate around the body. So theoretically, this could make it possible for lots of lactobacillus, the lactobacteria or bifidobacteria, to overgrow and then infect the patient. Those are patients who are really on their last legs. You know, they're very immunosuppressed and powerful.
Sepsis.
You know, you can develop. But another problem that can occur is you can actually get an overgrowth of lactobacillus in your gut. This is, again, in sick immunosuppressed patients. And you get what's called D-lactic acidosis. And that's a form of acidosis, excess acidity in the body, because we know these bacteria produce acid. That's a good thing. In a woman's vagina, you want to have an acid pH. In your intestinal tract, you want to have an acid pH because that fosters the growth of beneficial bacteria and prevents the growth of harmful bacteria, which like an alkaline environment. But in excess acidity, and particularly with a leaky gut, this could pass into the bloodstream in a weak, debilitated patient and make them acidotic. And, you know, these patients don't have the ability to balance their pH as well. Their kidneys are failing, perhaps, you know, and they're maybe having problems breathing. Key ways you can balance pH is through your kidneys and through your breathing. And then, you know, patients come to harm. So I guess maybe that's why it didn't work out in these really sick patients. Well, theoretically, it could be a benefit.
Also about probiotics, there is no such thing as one probiotic suits everybody. You know, there are different probiotics we use for different things like Crohn's or intractable diarrhea, other probiotics that we be careful with in other autoimmune conditions, yet other probiotics right after antibiotic use, traveling internationally, traveler's diarrhea. There's all kinds of probiotics out there.
Right. And it's different strokes for different folks. Some people do seem to have an allergy or an intolerance to probiotics that other people do perfectly fine with. And unfortunately, that's hard to predict at this point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I hope that the future will lead us to better tests, which will tell us which probiotics would be most desirable for patients, maybe custom probiotics for different purposes, probiotics that may enhance immunity or probiotics that may be helpful for yeast infections or probiotics that may be helpful for urinary tract infections or probiotics that may help allergies or probiotics that help ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease or even probiotics that help us lose weight because that actually is a prospect is that your gut bacteria may determine that. Even, you know, antidepressant probiotics that make you feel more euphoric.
Yeah, that's true. Kimchi may be the new Prozac.
Exactly.
As I read in a Psychology Today article.
I like
it. We are on the cusp of a revolution here in medicine with the discovery of the human microbiome.
Yeah.
And our microbiota, and it'll be fascinating to see what unfolds, what we find out, the different methods we could treat people and make them well, and I'm looking forward to all of that.
Yeah, I think we're at the point where Columbus set foot on what he thought was India, the New World, and began, learning the implications of his discovery, and it took centuries, really, to, ultimately nail it. Before they really figure
out. That's okay. We won't be around that long.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can put us in a time capsule or something. We'll freeze us ourselves.
Right. Right. Okay, Brian, thank you for your question. I hope we cleared that up for you. The next one is from Janice. What supplements do you recommend for people who have had their gallbladders removed? Do you recommend digestive enzymes? What kind? Plant or animal-based? Taken with meals or away from meals? I guess it would kind of depend. If somebody needs enzymes, it's usually for things like digestion issues or constipation. When a gallbladder is removed, tell me if I'm wrong, Dr. Hoffman, the gallbladder is the depot,
right,
where the liver secretes bile into the gallbladder, and it's a depot. And the gallbladder contracts when we have a meal that contains at least some amount of fat in it. The bile helps to emulsify the fat in our meal and to digest it and absorb it.
Right.
I think an initial problem people who have their gallbladders removed have is they have a little more diarrhea because the liver is secreting the bile, but there's no more depot. So maybe it's just kind of going in and it's a little too much bile.
Right.
I don't know.
What generally happens, though, and this indicates that people who had their gallbladders taken out don't so much have problems with digestion, is that it's very common for people who have gallbladder surgery to gain a lot of weight afterwards. And one of the reasons for that is that their gallbladder problems sort of put the brakes on their excessive eating. They could only eat small amounts. They had to avoid certain foods. And once their gallbladder is removed, the impediment to eating whatever the heck is on their plate is eliminated. And then they start eating like a house on fire. They're so happy that they can eat all kinds of foods that they weren't able to tolerate before. So a caution is in order for people who've had their gallbladder removed that you need to stay on a clean diet and don't go hog wild because you're so happy
exactly.
that you're not having right upper quadrant pain every time you eat.
Right, right. So the digestive enzymes are in order if, you're having indigestion-type problems or trouble moving your bowels possibly or bloating or anything like that.
And they're different. They're different ones. I mean, let's break it down. We've got the carbohydrate ones that break down carbohydrates. The things that like are beano, for example, is something that breaks down carbohydrates. And then there are the ones that are lipases. They break down fats. And then there are the proteolytic or protease enzymes that break down proteins. And certain products are combinations of all three, and certain products are just emphasizing one at a time. So, for someone who has fat intolerance, you want a lot of lipase. For someone who has a lot of, gas, bloating, flatulence when they eat, high-fiber foods, amylase to break down starch, exactly. Amylase breaks down starch. And some of these things that break down polysaccharides. And you can also get a vegetarian enzymes, but the vegetarian enzymes don't do a good job on fat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. Not enough lipase there.
Right.
So, yeah. We like Zygest. We like pancreatin. Most enzymes are pretty good. Even back in the day when I used to prescribe papaya enzyme or something. Bromelain is helpful. But a lot of these digestive enzymes have a combination.
By the way, papaya is an example of a vegetarian enzyme that breaks down protein and bromelain as well. These are sort of like meat tenderizers. They will actually help you digest meat. You can actually, when you're marinating meat, you marinate it in, pineapple juice. Pineapple juice, yeah. It will actually help to tenderize the meat.
Yeah.
Pre-digesting.
Do that for your brisket if your brisket is very, very
Or skirt steak or something like that.
Or a skirt steak, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next question comes from Maureen. Dr. Hoffman, do you have any recommended supplements for a burning mouth? I've developed symptoms over the past 4 to 6 weeks, which include dry mouth, metallic taste, and a tongue that feels like I burned it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very concerned.
Well, recently I got a bottle of expensive booze from a guy whose burning mouth syndrome I fixed.
Oh, really?
Remember that? That was a while ago, but maybe I didn't tell you about it, but we fixed his burning mouth. I mean, he was desperate because he'd been to all these doctors, oral surgeons, and we ultimately... we did it through a combination of strategies. Burning mouth can be due to some kind of inflammation in the mouth. It could be due to a yeast infection in the mouth, very commonly. That's actually what happened to one of our cancer patients who's doing quite well now. He was unable to eat. And during my physical exam, I said, looked at his mouth and said, oh my goodness, you've got an oral fungal infection. He was really immunosuppressed. He was barely standing up. He looked sort of like he was going to check out. And we gave him antifungal therapy. And now, months later, we're quite surprised. He's doing very well with intravenous vitamin C, and he's getting conventional treatment, of course, but it's amazing. So you make sure that there's not a yeast problem. Make sure that there are certain oral problems like lichen planus that can be painful. That's for an oral surgeon to determine.
Mm-hmm.
Also, make sure that people aren't chewing cinnamon gum or using a mouthwash that's irritating. Certain foods are irritating. And
mouthwash, people use mouthwash way too often, and most mouthwash contains alcohol. Alcohol is very drying.
But also very harsh chemicals, even carcinogenic, like Listerine and things like that. Very, very harsh.
Yeah.
So those are some things.
Some B vitamin deficiencies, possibly. In a burning mouth?
Well, another consideration with burning mouth is that sometimes it's a neurological condition, just like peripheral neuropathy. And there are studies which show that it responds to alpha-lipoic acid.
Oh.
So high-dose alpha-lipoic acid is good for peripheral neuropathy, which is burning and pain in the toes and the feet. And it can also be helpful for burning mouth syndrome. And there's actually medical articles that have been written on this subject. So... that's one of the treatments. Of course, sometimes medication is necessary because it's so painful. Usually you use a medication like Neurontin, which is something that is good for nerve pain to help quell the nerve pain.
Maureen mentions a metallic taste in her mouth, I wonder if she wouldn't benefit from seeing about heavy metal toxicity.
That is a possibility, but another aspect of metallic taste is that it's a corruption of the taste buds. The taste buds are not functioning properly due to some kind of irritation or inflammation, and it's almost like in a vision problem, you might have blurred vision, and when you have blurred tasting, something that is sweet might taste bitter, or it might taste metallic because it's a distortion in the nerves and the taste buds themselves. So that's one thing definitely to check, but I'm not entirely sure it means that she's laden with lead or mercury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Maureen. Best of luck. Our next question is from Marianne. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. In a recent clinical focus, your expert mentioned that kyolic aged garlic has been shown to regress plaque. For most of us listening, we probably won't have an imaging study done. For people like myself who don't know if plaque is present, is it safe for us to assume it is and take the recommended dose?
Well, I don't see why it's so hard to get that study. I mean, if it's not covered by insurance, it's relatively inexpensive. I think many places charge about $300 or $400 for the test. I think it's well worth undertaking just to get your status. Now, I recently read an article. I happen to be fascinated by Egyptian culture. I'm reading this big scholarly book on Egyptian history, and it's amazing. The Egyptians, like 4,500 years ago, built gigantic pyramids or engineering marvels. Just amazing.
Yeah.
But when you look at mummies and you put them into this imaging device, the same test that we would recommend to live people, it turns out they have calcium in their coronary arteries. And to my amazement, the very same guy who's doing the study on the mummies is the guy who's doing the study on aged garlic extract. We interviewed him. That's Dr. What the heck is his name? slips my mind for a moment. Mm-hmm. But it'll come back to me. But anyway, he's the expert on that. And he has demonstrated that, and this is across many cultures. You can look at Egyptian royalty. You can look at hunter-gatherers. It actually it argues for the ubiquity or commonness of arterial plaque as people age. And so it may be that just the presence of arterial plaque doesn't mean you're doomed. It's the quality of the plaque. It's whether you're obese and sedentary. It's whether you have coexisting risk factors like diabetes and hypertension, whether you have inflammation that's indicated by a C-reactive protein. So the presence of plaque isn't necessarily the crack of doom, but it is a signal that you're beginning to progress towards blockage.
Yeah. What is your recommended dose? That's another question she's fervently asking you.
I think
the expert you had on was said 100 milligrams. She's asking, is 1,200 better? Is 600 for prevention? What do you think?
The ones that we sell, I think there's 600 milligrams is the cardiovascular formula of Kyolic, and we recommend that people take two a day. I think the research that he did, they were using 1,000 milligrams.
Okay. Do you think this would also regress plaque in the carotid?
Absolutely. Why shouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to work. What's present in the heart is merely an indication of what may be present throughout the body. And its susceptibility in the heart indicates a susceptibility in the carotids. Usually there's not like a ton of plaque in the heart and completely clean carotids.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your question, Marianne. Our next question comes from Eric. Hello, Dr. Hoffman. I love your radio show and podcasts. I have a link from Dr. Nick Delgado's website about oral HGH. Can you give me and others some information about oral HGH? Is it bad or good? I respect your opinion.
It's worthless. It's worthless. It's a scam. It's absolutely of no benefit whatsoever. And then the question is, let's say it did work. Even if it did work, would you want to take it? And, you know, I think that there are benefits to be had from human growth hormone. But, I mean, in terms of muscle mass, in terms of recovery from injuries, I think that's why baseball players and other athletes have been tempted to use it. And it you know, can make you look really awesome. But studies have shown that in the absence of growth hormone, when animals don't grow, they're dwarfs, they're tiny, but they live about 50% longer. So I'm thinking, you know, you might look better, but will you live longer? And that's a concern.
Isn't the administration of human growth hormone also troubling in terms of possible cancer?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if it causes things to proliferate, then that's a potential problem. The doctor's name is Dr. Matthew Budoff.
Uh-huh.
Budoff, and I was amazed in an article about the mummies and looking at the remains of prehistoric folks who've been caught in tar pits and, you know, or frozen in glaciers, that when they analyze them, they all seem to have some degree of plaque if they're past a certain age.
Wow.
And so at first it was thought, well, yeah, sure, you know, the mummies, I mean, they were the royalty. They got to eat high on the hog. They ate a lot of grains. They ate a lot of sugar. Many of them were obese. Some of them had diabetes.
They had money. Sure.
But you know, even in some hunter-gatherer tribes where we really wouldn't expect to see a lot of plaque, they say that there's some atherosclerosis.
I would wonder what their diets consisted of. Was it a lot of bananas and sweet potatoes and maybe milk-containing products or something like that?
Who knows? I mean, there's even some speculation that one of the reasons that these people in prehistoric times got plaque is because they spent a lot of time in caves inhaling smoke from fires, from their cooking fires. And so, you know, this may have been a form of passive smoking.
They were smoking.
They were smoking. They were smokers.
They were smoking, yeah.
Or who knows what they were smoking. They were smoking, you know, local
there
herbs.
There is that, too.
Right.
Exactly. There might have been some kind of peyote going around.
Exactly. You know, whatever. Well, there were, you know, some risk factor that is unknown to us. So, anyway. All right.
Okay. All right. Do we have time for another question?
Yes, we do.
Great. This one comes from Lee. Okay. I can answer this question. Do high doses of fish oil, 4 large capsules, cause an oily nose? They can.
Okay.
I have testimony to that. As a matter of fact, I did take fish oil for a little while, and then I started to absolutely shine.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was taking not four capsules. Maybe I was taking one or two.
Right.
But then acne started to happen. But I am in the minority, everybody.
Yes.
I'm one of those minority people who, if I take a fish oil, I will tend to break out. Yes, I'm 50, and it can still happen. But when I don't take fish oil, everything is fine. I eat fish, low mercury fish, no problems, no issues, nothing like that. So high doses of fish oil can cause an oily anything, your nose, your skin, possibly.
Although not necessarily. You know, I mean, and there are some of our patients who, even though they're taking fish oil, their skin remains dry, and we encourage them to take more.
They've got to be quite deficient.
Yeah.
Or something else is going on. Yeah. Yeah. So that's something. I think the better skin oil is borage oil.
Borage oil, yeah,
borage
definitely.
The omega-3s, however, are very, very important. I think it's good for anybody to take fish oil. So.
Yeah, when we have patients who have dry skin or eczema, we urge, fish oil, but we also urge borage oil in combination with that. It's actually really been shown to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Lee, I hope that answers your question. Our next question?
Yeah, we have time for one short question.
One more?
Yeah.
Great. This is from Judy. I am an avid listener, and I'm wondering what Dr. Hoffman's thoughts are on thermography as opposed to mammography. I'd actually like to hear what you say about that.
Sure. We get that question quite a lot, in fact. And you know, what the difference is that mammography is an X-ray that's spread sensitive, and it can pick up calcification in the breast. And calcification is often a sign of cancer, although not always. So that's the confusing part of mammography. Not every calcification is a sign of cancer, and it creates a lot of false positives. And also, there are tumors that occur without calcification. So it's not a great tool. Even with the new iterations, you know, the 3D and all that stuff, it's just not a great tool. But it's the standard tool. It's the accepted tool. And unfortunately, it's the best tool that we have available. Now, thermography is different. What it does is it picks up changes in the pattern of heat in the breast, and that can shed some light on the presence of cancer, because cancer tends to be highly metabolic, and it creates sort of a hot spot. So in theory, it would be a great way to screen for cancer. However, I don't think that the science of thermography has been that well worked out. And so, you know, it's not standardized. I think the training is sporadic. I also think the equipment is not standardized. One of the appeals of thermography is that the equipment is much cheaper than having an X-ray unit in your office. Not an ordinary X-ray unit, but these modern mammography units cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you can get a thermography unit for a couple of thousand dollars. And so that's the appeal to some doctors, to maybe pick up a little extra income by saying, hey, I'll check your breasts with this. This is better than mammography. But, you know, another concern, I mean, I got to say that in a court of law, if you were to give a woman a clean bill of health based on thermography and they were to turn out to be suffering from breast cancer, that would be a slam dunk case of negligence, because you are not recommending the current standard of care for breast cancer prevention. And it's unfortunate we're in a litigious environment, but just that's the way the cookie crumbles. And our current standard of care is that we do offer women mammography with all its limitations. And oh, by the way, you know, these you know, we just had the race for the cure in the park, you know, with the pink everything, pink.
Susan G. Komen,
and they're saying, oh, you know, get your annual mammogram, you know, prevent cancer. Well, hey, guess what? There's a lot of studies that cast doubt on the efficacy of annual mammograms in terms of overall preventing cancer. Yes, they may save some women's lives, but they also create a lot of havoc, because there's unnecessary biopsies, unnecessary surgeries, unnecessary worry and apprehension.
And there's a lot of radiation from
that. And then there's, what are you going to do? You're going to start at 35 and you're going to get a mammogram every year until, what, you're 85? And then then there's also a point where, after a series of normal mammograms, maybe it's warranted for you to stop getting mammograms.
Yeah. What do you think of ultrasound instead?
Well, ultrasound is often combined with mammograms.
Yeah.
Ultrasound on its own is not a good screening tool, but in women who have dense breasts, they're often asked to get a mammogram and an ultrasound so that the two images can be compared. Women who have dense breast or fibrocystic breast. By the way, fish oil has been shown to alleviate breast density. We also use iodine in women who have fibrocystic breasts. And it's useful. And the advantage is, A, your breasts are less painful and hard, and B, it's actually easier to do an exam because it just drives doctors nuts to look at images from women who have dense breasts, because they see, it's like they see all this confusing. It's confusing. They see all this dense tissue, and it's like, oh, maybe it's something, but we can't see past the density that shows up as white that may conceal a cancer. Mm-hmm. And so it's a dense breasts are not just a nuisance to the woman who has them; it's a nuisance to the people who are trying to diagnose whether they're suffering from cancer.
Yeah. Judy, we hope that answers your question.
Yeah. I'm not a big, I could easily do it. I mean, that's something I could have a machine in the office, I could do it, but I've opted not to do it. It's something which needs more research and may have a place, but unfortunately it's not an alternative. So that's the deal. Pretty much that sums up today's issues. And if you'd like to get in on our Q&A sessions, you can email us your question to radioprogram@AOL.com. Make your question succinct. And for purposes of brevity, we will sometimes edit your questions. I notice you're doing that with some of the lengthy questions here. Because people want to recite their entire medical history, and they said, oh, by the way, I broke my ankle when I was 11. And, could that have something to do with the fact that now that I'm 82, I'm suffering from atrial fibrillation and, whatever.
Yeah.
So we've got to, I mean, this is a podcast. This is not a detailed medical workup like we might do in the office. All right. So that being said, thanks very much for joining us. Thank you, Layla. And make sure you join us again next week for our Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.